We are now going to discuss hung up on a dry drop. And the reason that I give this discussion is because in surveying almost 1,000 men and women on the dry drunk depression, I found out that about 50% or more of recovering alcoholics will undergo the dry drunk depression at some time or another in their recovery. And that's why I give this talk. Actually, I think that there is a danger period for falling into this sadness or deep depression. And the danger period would be from about 6 months after your final drink up to about 6 years. So that would be the danger period when it would most likely occur, between 6 months of abstinence up to 6 years of abstinence. But it can occur at any time. I just listed the period when it's most likely to occur in your life. Although there are lots of exceptions, most general rules do have exceptions. And I found out that one couple in Alaska, who were good friends of mine, this man and wife, both fell into the dry drunk syndrome 19 years after their sobriety, 19 years after their last drink. And therefore, it could happen at any time. However, after 5 or 6 years of serene sobriety, the chances are that you will never undergo the dry drunk depression. But I give it to forewarn you and to discuss what you can do to make it easier to recover. That's why I give it. And I have found lots of people on the dry drunk. Up above on the poster we have the dry drunk equals or is a prolonged alcoholic depression without alcohol. Prolonged alcoholic sadness without drinking. The dry drunk, secondly, is also emotional intoxication. Emotional intoxication. Now, please remember that toxic means poisonous. So when you are intoxicated, you are really poisoned because you cannot take this alcoholic beverage drink. And in this case, we are poisoned by negative, harmful emotions. Also, the dry drunk is SOSS. That stands for a state of sad sobriety. It does not mean the state of Oregon. It means a state or condition of sad sobriety, you see. All right, that's the acronym. And strangely enough, the dry drunk depression is always followed by a dry hangover. All right. Now, let me just read a few words from our co-founder, Bill Wilson. First, I wanted to open up by concluding the last talk on faith. And the one I wanted to read to you is Bill W.'s statement in March 1962, quote, "Acceptance and faith are capable of producing 100% sobriety." Those are the two ingredients, the only two he gives for serene or 100% sobriety. The ingredients are acceptance of life plus some kind of faith. A faith that he does not specify, because within the membership of AA, Al-Anon, and Alateen, our belief or faith is non-denominational, you see, and non-sectarian, basically. Although each one of us may have a particular church to which I adhere, which is fine. All right, then I wanted to conclude also by the theme song of my belief in the second step, Came to Believe. I believe for every drop of rain that falls, a flower grows. I believe that somewhere in the darkest night, a flower grows. I believe. A candle glows in the darkest night. A candle glows the light of our faith. I believe. Now here we have Bill Wilson's statement about the dry drunk condition written in 1954. Quote, "Sometimes we become depressed. I ought to know. I have been a champion dry bender case myself." He calls it a dry bender. to continue. I could accept my situation intellectually. Emotionally, I could not. To this problem of the dry drunk, there are certainly no pat answers. But part of the answer surely lies in the constant effort to practice all of the 12 steps of AA, which is one of the remedies. Now, this dry drunk syndrome is also called a dry binge, a dry spree. He calls it a dry bender. Over in Australia, they call it emotional inebriation. All right? Now, strangely enough, it is also followed by a hangover. So right away, we see that there's a tremendous similarity between the wet drunk condition when you're drinking and the dry drunk condition. Quote, when a wet drunk has a terrific hangover because he drank heavily yesterday, he cannot live well today. But there is another kind of hangover, which we all experience, whether drinking or not. That is the emotional hangover, which is a direct result of yesterday's excesses of negative emotions, anger, fear, jealousy, and the like. If we would live serenely today and tomorrow, we certainly need to eliminate these hangovers. That's on page 48 of As Bill Sees It. Now, then I come to the steps that are general, the steps that lead to depression. Generally, you become extremely impatient, much more impatient than you normally are, 100% more impatient. Secondly, generally speaking, you become overly ambitious or grandiose. And thirdly, you might become apt to make poor decisions. And that's a very dangerous inclination, making poor, destructive decisions, self-destructive. Now here, I would like just to briefly read the description of the dry drunk by Lewis Meyer, who wrote Off the Saw. He was a columnist for many years and a recovered alcoholic. Quote, there's one thing worse than a wet drunk, and that's a dry one. Some wet drunks are happy, gurgling fellows who smile a lot and pat everything fatable, either. But there's no such animal as a happy dry drunkard. Dry drunkards are moody, irritable people, interested in nothing, patabola otherwise. Dry drunkards are every bit as drunk as wet drunks. Both the wet and the dry drunk are goofy acting. They both get into all kinds of jams and messes, and they both end up mad at the world. Both the wet and dry drunk swear a lot. They both weave and chase. They both are abusive to people they love. The only real difference is that wet drunks drink whiskey and dry drunks don't. Well, actually, there are more physical differences because the dry drunkard has stopped physically abusing his liver and heart muscles and so on because of the fact that he has quit ingesting this alcohol, this dangerous drug. Now, as far as overly ambitious is concerned, that simply means that we have become too grandiose. In other words, we have high ideals and goals, which is good, but we have not yet the conditions to achieve them. You see, it is as if a person got out of a treatment center and expected that 1 week later they would be invited to Hollywood for a screen test. You see, it may take a couple of months before you're offered a screen test in Hollywood. Meanwhile, you may have to pump gas in San Jose for a while. Da 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 in San Jose. All right. However, we've got to hang on to our goals and ambitions. I always have. And without arrogance, I can say that right now I've managed to achieve two of my three major goals in life. And I see some indication that perhaps one day I may achieve the third and final goal. At least I hope so. So do not give up your dreams, but try to make them practical. It may take you a little longer. Perhaps you'll need more training. Maybe you'll need more money. But don't give up on your dreams. As the old country rock road song, hang on to your dreams on that highway 218. Don't give up on that highway 218. I gave up on Highway 26, but here I am. All right. Well, let me go ahead to forehead number three. We are apt to make poor decisions. I think that this is a very dangerous situation because many bad decisions are made when we are depressed or down on the dump. Therefore, I now read the wise advice in a letter of Bill Wilson, 1960, quote, he's writing this to a friend. During acute depression, avoid trying to set your whole life in order all at once. If you take on duties so heavy that you're sure to fail in them at the moment, then you are allowing yourself to be tricked by your unconscious. He concludes, therefore, it is best to begin with whatever the irreducible minimum of activity is, and then work for an enlargement of these activities day by day. In other words, we have to be most careful not to take on something that's too heavy for us when recovering from alcoholism, you know. And that means that you should not plunge into making all sorts of heavy decisions right away. Heavy decisions to shake the person you're living with or married to. Heavy decision to sell your house, to get rid of your job and go down to Hollywood and become a big movie star. See? We have to be careful about our decisions. Now, what are the signs of this insane unhappiness that we call a dry drunk? I call it the insane unhappiness because most people on the dry drunk do act crazily. And as I just read, they end up in jams and messes and mad at the whole world, which is something we certainly do not want. First of all, I have put just a few of these symptoms or signs of the dry drunk depression up here. I couldn't get them all on the poster. Physical signs, you become on edge physically. That is so much that even your nerve endings may be numb or tingle, and you may develop, secondly, an unexplainable rash, a rash on your face or shoulders or chest that is inexplicable. In fact, my doctor, when I was on a dry drunk depression for the second time, he could not explain this thing and this rash that I had. And he wrote it down as something new in the medical books, and he called it the crash rash. No, but I do get that when I get depressed. We also have chronic fatigue, and that symptom is always present. You develop chronic fatigue. You also may develop a dry, cottony mouth in the morning, even though you're not drinking or taking drying out medication or tranquilizers. Finally, you may indulge or be subject to blackouts. Sometimes you can't remember what happened the night before. And by the way, I do have a few pamphlets left on this whole subject. I think about 10 I have left. We've had to order 1,000 more. And I have, I brought about 60 pamphlets on serenity also. Now see, that fly is depressed. You know, because he can't get out of here. But I got 3 flies in the bathroom who cannot get out. You see, that's where freedom comes in. I like that discussion last night on freedom, because that's what we need, is more freedom and freedom from fear. Now, let me read a couple more of these that are not on the poster for lack of faith. Here's some more physical symptoms. You might develop, once again, the shakes and hand tremors. That's common. You might develop muscle spasms and twitches, leg jerks. Insomnia is common. Stiff neck and shoulders. Sometimes people will alternate heavy perspiration with chills, heavy sweats and chills. This is all on the dry drunk syndrome, even though they do not have a cold or the flu. Other people will develop their old habits of biting nails again or hangnails, and some will develop a fast, irregular pulse and a pounding heart. I got that pounding heart that scared the dickens out of me. Others may develop a lowered blood pressure, along with tension headaches. Also, stomach cramps and pain. And one of the dangers is you may develop, once again, a craving for booze, craving for alcoholic beverages. As a matter of fact, Bill Wilson went through this, and he had a terrible time, as some of you know from reading his book. Here, he told about his co-founder in AA, Dr. Bob S. Quote, for Dr. Bob, his insatiable craving for alcohol was evidently a physical phenomenon, which bedeviled his first years in AA. This was a time when only days and nights of carrying the message of sobriety to other alcoholics could help Dr. Bob to forget about his craving to drink. Now, that's really an amazing statement. Imagine being bothered for years, the co-founder of AA, by this craving to drink again. And I'm happy that I didn't have that craving so long as he did, as long as he did. All right, then there's another symptom which I like to discuss, and that is this, that you may develop the inner urge of aimlessness. Now, this is a peculiar symptom to recovering alcoholics, aimlessness. What it really means is that when you get on the dry drunk sadness, it seems that your feet or your gas pedal have a kind of built-in magnet. And aimlessness is a very, very bad danger signal. That is, you're going to start out, you feel like you've got to get out of this place. You're going to start out and go someplace aimlessly. Walk someplace with no goal, or drive rapidly someplace with no goal. See? Well, that's bad, especially in the first 6 months of sobriety. Because, seeing that you do have a kind of unexplainable magnet in your feet and in the gas pedal, you start off full with good intentions, but you always seem to hear, not knowing how, you're never paddling. And that is a danger of aimlessness, that you drift aimlessly towards the nearest place to drink. See? So you got to watch out for that, of not having a place or a goal when you start walking or driving. Oh, it doesn't mean that you can't take an aimless walk, you know, especially when you've been sober a while. But we still have to be careful when you have a car ready and you don't know where you're going. That can be very dangerous, you see. You might end up at a house all lit up with red lights. Yes. Or something like that. All right. Well, let me go ahead here. And that is to the emotional symptoms that we can have. Here, I've just put down a few. You might become oversensitive again. That is hypersensitive. Hypersensitive. And people cannot make remarks to you because you get all upset. You cannot take any criticism at all. And secondly, once again, you might become moody and irritable, unaccountably irritable, because you don't know why you are irritable. Chronic boredom is also present in all dry drunk depression. Chronic boredom and chronic fatigue. You might also develop into a hypercritical person. A nagging person, nagging everybody and criticizing everything, which is something we don't want, because we need more acceptance of other people, even of their faults. And as we said before, you also become sad. Here I'm stressing you become physically sad. That is, even your friends notice that now your shoulders are drooping and you're walking very hesitantly, you see. And even you feel pains in your legs and arms. A kind of physical sadness can accompany the dry drunk. And this often occurs in withdrawal symptoms also. Often, very often. So some of these symptoms are quite similar to early withdrawal symptoms, but it's not the same. Because this is a very deep, lasting depression that can destroy you if you're not careful. All right? Now let me go ahead. Overall, the picture of myself depressed is that you are very upset and unrealistic. Very upset because your emotions are all topsy-turvy and you find it difficult to cope, as Bill Wilson said, difficult to cope with your situation. And you have lost insight. We mentioned that in one of the previous talks. You have lost that valuable human quality, insight, which is very similar to feminine intuition. That is, we need insight to instantly grasp the situation. Are these people hostile to me? Are they all sincere? Is this an honest situation? What should I do? Should I quit my job, ask for a raise, or what? That all requires insight. And you lose insight on the dry drunk depression. That's why no important decisions are to be made when you're very depressed. And no important letters are to be mailed when you are deeply depressed. No important letters. You should keep them on your desk for 48 hours before you decide whether to call the boss, a confounded SOB, and then mail it to him. You see? All right. Okay. Now, here are some of the causes of the dry drunk sadness, which I'll briefly go into here. As we mentioned already, you may have a renewed craving for booze, a renewed craving for alcohol. And that, of course, if you're not careful, can lead to a sudden ingestion of alcoholic beverage and getting drunk. As a matter of fact, in this other fine book, How to Live with an Alcoholic by Dr. George Valez of Houston, he lists this whole thing under a chapter called BUD, Bud, Building Up to Drink. Building up to drink. And he points out where our irritability becomes heightened, we become more and more restless and aimless, and finally we reach the stage of acute anxiety, which he grasps right here in this book. And then one of two things will happen. In this stage of acute anxiety and sadness, either you're going to resolve it by drinking heavily again, or you're going to seek the means of recovery. You're going to slowly gain control of yourself, once again, which we recommend, you see, through the remedies listed below on the bottom of the poster. All right? I might mention that we are also concerned with hypoglycemia, particularly among recovering alcoholics. And I'm reading here from the Star, November 18th, 1980. I'm not quoting it, but I'm listing the fact that hypoglycemia, or low blood sugar level, will often lead to fatigue, nervousness, irritability, and confusion. And if you have those symptoms, you don't need a glucose tolerance test. But you do need a regulation of your diet. And the actor Burt Reynolds is one of the most famous hypoglycemics, because he didn't know he had this condition for many years until he went to a good doctor. And now he eliminates all sugar and all alcohol from his diet and increases the number of times a day that he eats. I myself, when I'm home, try to eat 5 to 6 small meals a day. All high-protein food, if I can possibly do it. High-protein, avoiding fats and sugars. So much for hypoglycemia. Now, here are some of the other causes of the dry drunk. Number two, a conflict or tragedy can trigger off the dry drunk depression. That means a severe conflict or striking tragedy in your daily life. One conflict might be within you, for example, shall I go back to light social drinking or shall I quit entirely? Now, that can trigger off a real conflict within you. Shall I drink lightly or quit entirely? You see? Because on Fridays I have fish. And as everybody knows, white wine goes well with fish, you see. This is all self-deception. But anyway, you have to be aware of this conflict within you. Because if you do not resolve conflict, if you are indecisive, that can make you depressed. Why does indecisiveness make me depressed? Because human beings are meant to be decisive. You are not meant to fiddle around with arguing with yourself and never coming to any conclusion. You've got to make decisions every day and make important decisions. You just can't remain indecisive. It's not the human way of successfully conducting your life, right? It's better to make the wrong decision than to sit there and do nothing. Sometimes it's better. All right. A severe tragedy can also trigger off this depression in an alcoholic. That is, a sudden automobile wreck in which you lose family members, or a fire in which some of your family are injured or killed. These are so deep, these tragedies, that it can lead to long-lasting depression. And you need to be very, very careful at a time of tragedy, even minor tragedies. You see? Or a big tragedy like losing a job you've had for many years, which can also trigger off very deep depression. You see? So we really need to be happy and joyful of heart, as we are advised by many experts, including the Bible. But that doesn't mean that when you go to funerals like your uncle or aunt, When you go to funerals, you don't have to go around telling jokes and clapping people on the back. There's a place for everything. All right. Let me see here if I can stress the five causes that are also listed in the big book, except number E, the fifth chapter of the big book. Under number A, first of all, you may again become self-centered when you are depressed. And here I would like to read the words of Bill Wilson about being self-centered again and to what he likened it. I quote from this, which is in AA's big book, page 60. Most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show and is forever trying to arrange the lights, the scenery, and the rest of the players in his own way. Manipulation. He concludes, what usually happens? Well, the show doesn't come off very well, and he becomes angry, indignant, and full of self-pity. That's what we call the superstar symptom, where you have a false view of life in which you imagine that you are the superstar of this play or this movie about your life. And somehow or another, you get the idea that everybody around you is just a bit player and that they are little tiny character actors. And they're supposed to speak their lines correctly to build you up. Are you following me? In other words, this is a fantasy in which the people around you don't build you up by the lines they speak in this movie of your superstar life. They don't speak their lines correctly and respectfully. Well, then you get very angry at them and resentful and full of self-pity. As a matter of fact, the truth of life is that you are not a superstar. That everybody else is just as important as you are. See? That's reality, not fantasy. Reality. Or everybody is a superstar. Put it that way, too. Everybody around me is also a superstar. And therefore, I'm not more important than anybody else. That calls for balance and realism. All right? Now, the next one, number B, I have listed there some of the chronic negative emotions that, if not controlled, can lead to the lasting dry drunk depression, a lasting sadness. Number one, of course, is chronic resentment. And as I mentioned to someone, we do not need to be concerned about spontaneous negative emotions. There is no way you can stamp out reactions like sudden anger or sudden resentment when you're put down or fear when you're walking around a path on Mount Hood and all of a sudden you come face to face with a towering 1,500-pound grizzly bear. Well, you would be excused if you experienced a sudden fleeting emotion of fear or turned around and beat it. All right? So there's no use in trying to eliminate all spontaneous emotions. You'd be a fool to try that because we are human. What we want to do is to try to control and ultimately to eliminate, if possible, these harmful chronic negative reactions, among which are resentment, and I quote from the big book, page 64, resentment is the number one offender. It, resentment, destroys more alcoholics than anything else. And from it stem all forms of spiritual illness. That's enough said on that. We also list fear up there. And here I'd like to quote Bill Wilson again from the big book. Fear is an evil and corroding thread, touching every aspect of our lives. Fear is fatal because fear shuts out reality and the sunlight of God. Shuts out reality and God's sunlight. Then, with regard to lust, I could read you from the pages of the big book, but it's quite long in there. The ultimate summary of Bill W.'s remarks is that we should try to avoid selfish desire for others. A selfish love that is concerned only with your own personal satisfaction and not concerned with the genuine personality of the other person. So I guess here we're speaking about somebody who pains others to indulge in sex. that is not totally self-disinterested. It is really selfish in many cases, most cases. So here we got to go back again to what is an unselfish and genuine love of the opposite sex and everybody else. We will discuss that in this afternoon's talk on the church. And finally, we have anger. Bill Wilson wrote about this. Anger is poison for the alcoholic. And he cautions that maybe the other person is wrong in this case, or more sick than I am, so we ought to forgive the person and pray for him or her. All right? And here I want to bring in my reaction to all of this about anger. And I have told many persons, and there's a lot of literature written on the subject of positive anger. Now, Bill W. is most definitely speaking about negative anger. No question about it. Anger that does no good to yourself or to the other person. But we have a very fine book called The Angry Book by Dr. Ted Rubin, which is a very well-reviewed book, in which he mentions that it is possible to become justly angry with other persons and to release that anger to them, even though perhaps we could express it in another way. Release that anger through exercise and through playing tennis or something, or jogging, which may be safer for the alcoholic. But nevertheless, I have become convinced, and I practice it in my daily life, that sometimes the release of positive anger is the only way you can get over and across to people, particularly if they are repressing you or putting you down. In fact, he mentions Jesus Christ, although this is not a Christian book. As I do, he uses an example from the Bible. And he says, Jesus Christ himself got angry with the Pharisees, angry with the apostles, and with the money changers in the temple. In fact, he was so angry at these small businessmen who were selling lambs and pigeons for the Old Testament sacrifices, he became so angry that he cried out, "You are making my father's temple a den of thieves." And he picked up a whip and drove them out of the temple area and kicked over their tables with all the money on it. And so I believe that sometimes we should not repress our anger, particularly with a person close to us, but should express it immediately rather than let it drag on and become chronic resentment, simmering within yourself, you see? Of course, there are, as I said, physical means of relieving our anger and so on. I don't see it here, but the Japanese have a very fine outlook on that. At least in one factory in Osaka, the Electric Industrial Company of Osaka, Japan. And in this company, if they see that an employee is getting uptight or very irritable or angry, especially angry, they send the employee to the self-control room. And here they have the option of several services. First of all, they can use the angry telephone line. And they go into a soundproof booth and they pick up the phone and they are allowed 1 minute, 60 seconds, in which they can rant and rave over the telephone and curse the supervisors and swear to their heart's content. And then they listen and they get a soft, sweet message of sympathy and condolence, you know. Yes. A feminine voice. And in this case, it seems to work because that plant has drastically reduced its days off and its incidence of ulcers. Now, we have another way to look at it, too, and that is that we can turn negative anger into something positive if we are inclined and willing to do so. As he mentioned, and I stress, you can turn your anger into concern for the other person who made you mad. Even though you don't have to become a close friend of that guy or gal, you can still pray for him or her. You can still pray for him or her. And as we'll explain in the next talk, you are not required to like everybody, but you are required to love everybody and to wish the best for every person. We'll distinguish about that in the next talk. Now, number three, the resultant of all these chronic negative emotions would be self-pity. And of course, the long-standing AA expression is, don't sit on the pity pot. Do not sit on the self-pity pot. And of course, that is very good advice. Because self-pity results in isolationism. self-pity results in your staying in your room and sympathizing with yourself and isolating yourself from meetings that could help you and from friends who could help you. We don't want self-pity. That's the ultimate isolationism. Now, here's another cause of the dry drunk depression, the emotional teeter-totter. What's that mean? It means that you are constantly going up and down. One minute you're quite high, as drug addicts can get. The next minute you're quite low, depressed. The next minute or next half hour, you're way up in the clouds again. Next 10 minutes, you're down in the dumps, depressed. We have got to stop that emotional teeter-totter emotion. You've got to remain more on an emotional level plane. Nobody can live like that. It is extremes of emotion. I learned that long, long ago. And I would refuse to go up and down on that teeter-totter. And now finally I can make my day more equitable, more serene. You see? Finally, we are to avoid HALT, an acronym standing for H equals avoid hunger, as Burt Reynolds says. Burt Reynolds said he cannot allow himself to get hungry because he then becomes very irritable. Number two, avoid anger. That is, avoid unjust, negative anger that's no good to you or others. L, avoid loneliness. Avoid loneliness because that results in self-pity. Now, it does not say avoid aloneness, because many of our most creative men and women are alone a great deal. Alone a great deal of the time, writing songs or writing letters or essays or novels. They are alone, but they are not lonely. You see the difference. And finally, we are to avoid tiredness, to try to avoid getting too fatigued. Now, I can't always do that because I have schedules, but I try to avoid it, and if possible, to take a nap sometimes, which is very helpful. So, we now come to the remedies for the dry drunk depression. Number one, we must try to acknowledge our sad feelings and accept them. We must admit that I feel terrible. I must admit to myself that I've got a bad toothache, rather than deny it. You see? I must admit that I feel terrible and accept it for the time being until I can change it. And being creatures of intellect and free will, we can change practically every negative emotion to a more positive one, which we will see in the final talk. Number two, if you are depressed, try to attend more meetings of AA rather than fewer. That's very important. But try to avoid meetings which experience has taught you are abrasive to your psyche. That is, you meet people there who don't like you or they contradict you and so forth. Go to some other meetings. You don't have to go to meetings where you feel uncomfortable. I never do. At least I won't go back again. So that's important, not to stay alone in your room, but to go to more meetings of AA. Number three, and this is very important, if you are depressed more than 48 hours or down the dumps, you must seek counsel and advice immediately. You must never be deeply depressed more than 2 days and nights without consulting somebody. I can't stress that enough. Does it have to be a doctor? No, it can be your best friend. First of all, it ought to be your sponsor in AA. Or it can be your confessor or parish priest, your favorite doctor, or whomever. Why? Because the important thing here is not the advice you may get, but opening up your heart and relieving yourself of all these worries and these poisons within you, filling it all out. That's the important thing. And then you will feel better. You'll feel better. All right, now let me go to the next one. It is also important when depressed to keep dizzy and to exercise. To keep dizzy means that you try to use your free time in productive ways. We'll see in the next talk that we need a good hobby. At least it is a help to have a constructive hobby in which you are interested, such as making flies for fishing or some hobby that you like. For myself, it's writing pamphlets or writing talks and so on. And number two, the exercise is very important also. Why? Because we'll see in the next talk that exercise doubles the hormone norepinephrine in your bloodstream. And this hormone, norepinephrine, is an anxiety-killing hormone. It raises your spirit. And I'm speaking here of a minimum of 10 minutes at least of daily exercise, preferably a half hour to an hour of exercise. And I think that has helped me more than any one other thing, particularly when I was astonished to find out that despite recommended surgery on the two bottom discs of my spinal column, I was able to alleviate quite a bit the condition of sore and weak legs simply by exercise. And I'm greatly, greatly pleased at that situation. All right, number five, we should try to control our emotions. What does that mean, basically? It means simply that we try to control our emotions much sooner than we used to. That is, you do not allow your emotions to become chronic, your negative emotions. You try to take steps as soon as you notice them to eliminate these negative, harmful emotions. All right? Now, number six is not my idea, but it is the idea of many writers, especially Lewis Meyer in his book, Off the Saw. Number six, be godly, light, and pray. This is what he wrote on page 98 of his book, Off the Saw. Quote, there is no failure in life if you can still pray. Now that you are sober, it seems that a dry drunk is the next best thing. But try to pray. Prayer restores a man's dignity and pride in himself. This is no new discovery with me. The 30th Psalm said it better. Quote, O Lord my God, I cried out unto thee, and thou hast healed me. Well, do you know what he's doing there? He's speaking to the divine physician. And the dry drunk is an illness, you see. And you might as well ask the doctor about it. And the most powerful doctor is our divine physician, our higher power. Let me close with the poem, anonymous poem, in the back of my little pamphlet on the dry drunk. It's addressed to the third person of God, but I only read it not for religious reasons, but because this poem asks our higher power for the qualities directly opposed to the negative feelings of the dry drunk sadness. If you listen, you'll see what I mean. Come, Holy Spirit of God, replace the tension within me with a holy relaxation. Replace the turbulence within me with a sacred calm. Replace the anxiety within me with a quiet confidence. Replace the fear within me with a stronger faith. Replace the bitterness within me with the sweetness of thy grace. Replace the coldness within me with a loving warmth. Replace the dark night within me with thy glorious day. Replace the cold winter within me with thy coming spring. Straighten out my crookedness. Fill up my lonely emptiness. Dull the edge of my selfish pride and sharpen the edge of my humility. O Holy Spirit of God, let me see myself as you see me so that I can see you more clearly as you have promised. Well, thank you very much.
Also on three pillars. Namely, first of all, on the foundation or pillar of our physical needs correctly fulfilled. Secondly, in the foundation or pillar of our psychological needs. And thirdly, on the pillar or foundation of our creative needs. And I also wanted to interrupt you with a joke that I just found in the restroom. In the 1980 issue of Reader's Digest November, the minister of the local church was walking down the street one day when he recognized a town drunk unsteadily ambling along towards him. The minister remarked as they met, drunk again. The drunk tipped his hat and said, me too. And I like this one about honesty, which we're going to discuss. This is honesty in the Indian way. A cowboy riding across the prairie came upon an Indian lying on the ground with his ear pressed to a wagon track. The Indian said, wagon, two horses, man drives smoke pipe, woman in black dress, wear bonnet. Cowboy said in amazement, "You mean you can tell that, Indian, just by listening to the ground?" Indian, "No, half hour ago, run over me." I wanted to tell you that I consider this retreat in my six talks a kind of a six classes. And instead of psychology or psychology, we call our little effort up here psychoceramics, which is the study of crackpots. So much for that. I'm not putting you down, you're already there. But anyway, our physical needs fulfilled. Well, I think that I'll spend the least time on this because the other items I would consider more important. But at the same time, I have to insist that all of our psychological and creative ability ultimately rests upon our physical well-being. And I really see no reason to question that. It's been true in my own life. If I feel well, I can emotionally ride any storm, and I can continue to be creative. If I don't feel well physically, it's not the case at all. Now, we have five items here and five items on the second foundation of maturity. First of all, we see the need for a balanced diet. Now, since we've already mentioned that, I don't intend to go into it more. But I did mention that we definitely should stick to a high-protein diet. A high-protein and, if we can, sugarless diet. Benefiting from the vitamins and minerals that we do get from the many high-protein foods. And in particular, and it's very true in our Northwest, fish are very helpful, and lean meats, and especially leafy fruits and vegetables of any kind whatever, particularly raw fruits and vegetables. These, I think, are very, very helpful. And to avoid loading up on ice cream and candy bars and so on, because ultimately this will result in a low blood sugar level rather than a higher blood sugar level. So watch your diet closely. I think it's very, very important. Number two, we should try to get enough sleep. Well, I don't mean that for this present location. What I do mean is that when you get back to your permanent residence, you should make sure that you get, at least until you're 80, a minimum of 7 to 10 hours of rest every day. I'd say 9 to 10 hours of rest every day. I don't use the word sleep, although it's up there. I would rather prefer the word rest. That is, your body will regain its strength and recoup its energies if you are resting a minimum of 8 to 10 hours every day. If you can't do that, try to take a nap and catch up when you can, particularly on the weekends. Instead of watching the Seattle Seahawks, take a nap. You might as well anyway. What we should have is the Oregon Occidentals or something like that, football team. Now, this one here, exercise, I've already pointed out that in another talk. I do have the clipping here, but I'm not going to emphasize that again. The clipping does emphasize that daily exercise, a minimum of 10 to 15 to a half hour, minimum of 10 minutes, does very definitely double the amount of the hormone norepinephrine, which is also called noradrenaline. And this is an anxiety-fighting, a depression-countering hormone in the bloodstream. And it very, very definitely elevates your feeling of well-being or euphoria, which you used to seek in a drink, a well-being or euphoric feeling. Now you should try to get it through exercise. And I'm currently beginning to use an exercise bicycle, and I think that it's helped me a great deal. So look into your routine of exercise during this period of reflection and see what you can change in your exercising. And practically everybody can exercise. There's some joggers in Seattle over 80, and they're still going at it. Number 4D is recreation. Well, to my mind, this is extremely important because we do tend to get stress-ridden in this competitive world of ours. Even the job market is very competitive, and you have to really work hard, perhaps, at retaining your job. And therefore, we do have to relax. Here I would suggest that you recreate and relax in something that helps you, not what helps the people you're going out with. And if some of my friends or a Jesuit priest is going to a movie that I'm not interested in, I don't go. Because I come first. We all come first. We have to look out after ourselves first of all. We have to love ourselves before we love others correctly. So do what you think is best for your relaxation. If I get uptight, I go to an excellent movie that I'm interested in. And also, I think you can combine exercise with recreation. For example, if you like to bowl, there you recreate and you're also exercising. To my mind, that's very good. Or swimming with a group and so on. With couples, I've preached for years that they should try out the mini vacation. And I know it has worked with a number of couples that they try every 2 or 3 months to go out together to a different city, to leave all the children and cares behind, to register in a nice motel or hotel, in a large city perhaps, where they can go shopping, they can go eating out in a choice of restaurants, see movies or stage plays. I think that's a very good piece of advice, because about 4 times a year they get away from it all. And it has saved, I think, a lot of marriages. The mini vacation. And by all means, get your wife to finance it. Yes, I think that's fly again. I think that number E is quite important, that we need a hobby. Well, it's not put down there as a necessity. It's a recommended idea. Because I've noticed that people who seem to maintain their sobriety a little easier than others are those with a hobby. And if you do have a hobby, by all means, improve yourself in it, extend your area of the hobby, and stick with it. And I don't know what it is. Some people like to paint or draw. Others like to work with ocean driftwood. These are people in halfway houses where I lecture. Others make beautiful lampstands and things like that. So whatever your hobby is, if you like it, stick with it. It's not necessity, speaking here, but I think it's very helpful. All right? So much for our physical needs, but they are very important. Now we come to fulfilling the second foundation on the mature person, that is our psychological need, that is our emotional and mental and spiritual need. Number A, we need self-honesty. Here I believe that we've come to the foundation of all sobriety, that we simply have to be honest with ourselves. And I know I failed in this in quite a long period of time, and some of my friends have failed to be totally honest with themselves. They do not see the whole person when they look in the mirror of retrospection. And one fellow told me a couple weeks ago in the Pioneer Center Treatment Center in Seattle, he said that he looked at that statement and he said, "By gosh, I'm beginning to understand why I've been in so many treatment centers, in some more than once, because I have not truly been honest with myself. I have not faced up to the real me. I've not faced up to the nagging problem of my own defects and insufficiencies, how I need to correct myself, because it's pretty tough to do that." And so far as I know, he's really staying sober. So think about that we have to be honest with ourselves and honest with others. You cannot be honest with your friends and relatives if you're not totally honest with yourself. You'll always be covering up something. Like the lady, as we said the other day, who wanted to mask the beer spilt on the priest's black coat. She wanted to mask it with perfume, which wasn't exactly honest anyway. So think about that. If you're striving to be honest and react to difficult moral situations according to your conscience, do we have a conscience? Absolutely. All philosophers admit to the fact that we somehow can distinguish right from wrong, different from the mere animal. That is, you have a yellow warning light when you come to some intersection, a moral problem, and then you have a red light, and you go through that red light at your own risk. The red light says, no, don't cross through here now. Don't do this. Don't commit this action. And you disregard that red light at your own risk. The conscience is also a very powerful spotlight. It spotlights not only your present problem, but also the immediate solution. And there's no way you can get away from that. No way you can avoid seeing what ought to be done. And the basic moral principle in the universe has always been, try to do what is good and to avoid what is evil. Do what is good and avoid what is evil. Before we go ahead, I want to also mention that self-honesty applies to everybody around you, even on the freeway. And I remember looking at the back seat, the back window of a Volkswagen, and this little rabbit had a sign in the back window, "Attention, car thieves, this VW is already stolen." Now, that's why I need my honesty towards others. All right? B and C are the most important points on the whole poster. Absolutely. Number B, we have a need to love others and a need to be loved in return. And number C, we have a great need to feel worthwhile again, to feel really worthwhile down deep. Now, let me briefly go into that love and be loved. It is true that this works even on a desert island. If you're marooned from a plane crash or shipwreck, you still have a basic need to be loved, even if you're all alone on that deserted island. The need does not change. And if there's nobody for you to love, the need still remains unchanged. I suppose it is because we are born to love, even more than the animals, whose love is basically materialistic and instinctual. We are born to love others in a spiritual manner, as well as in a physical and emotional way. I don't deny that. We do admit that throughout the world there are hundreds of thousands of priests and nuns and even some ministers who have embraced celibacy. That is, they have chosen not to marry and to enjoy physical love because they wish to totally commit themselves to an all-out service of God and to dedicating their physical rights to Him. Now, some would say that that is unnatural and also impossible. Well, it is neither unnatural nor impossible. It is not truly unnatural because we don't have to have sex. It's unnatural in the sense that most people are born to that life. But it is also not impossible because we have the grace of God always present, which has supported and buoyed up down the ages millions of priests and nuns and ministers who have chosen not to marry. It is possible because of the grace of God and also because of sublimation. That is, sublimation meaning that they can use their other outlets of service to others to replace this desire for sex. Enough said on that. Anyway, I wouldn't even consider marriage unless I stumbled across a short, wealthy widow. If you know any such, let me know. Yes. So we do need to get involved in friendship. And when I say love, I'm not speaking only about physical love, which is good, of course, and blessed by Almighty God. But I'm speaking about the love you had for your father and mother, love you have for your uncle and aunt, for your kids, and for your friends. This is all a case of human love, which is the highest form of activity, human love. We need to get involved with groups about whom I care, whether it's an AA group or a parent-teachers association or whatever. And we also need, I would say, to have one or two very close friends. If you have one or two close friends, you are rich indeed. You are a rich person. Friends you can count on. Friends who will not be surprised by anything you tell them. That's a very great, rich blessing. I do believe that even pop music goes along with our ideas on love. For example, what the world needs now is love, sweet love. That's the only thing that we've just too little of. What the world needs now is love, sweet love. No, not just for some, but for everyone. That is, we are called on to love everyone. Even if you dislike cruel and heartless people, you are still called upon inwardly to wish them well, to wish them happiness, to wish them the best. And we can do that because we are spiritual people. And because love is two-sided. On one side, we have the coin of affective love for others and our interest in them. On the other flip side of the coin, we have love in service. That is, performing little services of love to those around us. Even little things like helping with the dishes and emptying ashtrays and cleaning Father Billy's room, etc. You see? Little acts of service. All right. Now, I love that fly, but I don't like him. Sometimes also I believe that we forget about sick relatives or friends in rest homes. I go and visit my Aunt Martha, who is now 94, and she's very active and likes to see visitors. But some of these poor people, I think they're, even our relatives, they are all alone by the telephone, waiting for a ring from you. They're all alone, and you never call them. You're too busy to phone them. Maybe somebody wonders where you are. It doesn't take much to phone them. But sometimes we're too lazy to do what we really ought to. Also, I remember some of the bumper stickers that emphasize, oh, touching people, or telling them that you love them, which we are sometimes too embarrassed to do. Have I told you lately that I love you? Have I told you lately that I care? Sometimes we're too embarrassed to tell people openly that we love them, or to touch our children affectionately, or each other affectionately, you know. Because as one married person put it, there is not enough touching among married couples, friendly, affectionate touches, and even among our friends. So I think we ought to remember that, because it all goes back, I think, to God is love. I don't know if you've read the first epistle of John, in which he speaks about love. And he ends up with those three most mysterious words in all of literature, God is love. Why didn't St. John write, God loves us? Why didn't he write, God is a loving being? No, he chose to write, God is love itself. And I've reflected on that for years and years. It's a very beautiful phrase on which to meditate, and on its possible connection with our own human way of loving and our need to be loved. It's worth thinking about. And then there's that other one about the lonely people. Every day I wake up, and then I start to break up. Lonely is the man without love. Lonely is the woman without love. Every day I start out, then I eat my heart out. Lonely is the man without love. Eat your heart out, Engeldink. I really meant Tom Jones. Well, you know, you can see what happens to animals who are not loved. And that same thing happens to people who don't get enough love from you. For example, go to a dog or cat pound. There you will find lost animals who are just pining away within the confines of the pound. Some of them are dead within 2 weeks. They're dead because their master is not around. And they just pine away out of love and of not being paid attention. They want to be called by their name. The dog knows its own name, so does the cat. And that's what happens to animals, and the very same thing happens to us. We need to be loved, to be cared about, cared for. But if you don't get it, or your love is rejected, just remember that you must pick up the pieces and dare to love again. Too many of us are edgy when we find a broken friendship or a broken marriage. But we just have to keep in mind that we might as well give up the whole battle of life if we are not courageous enough to love again, to dare to love again. Now we come to number C. We must feel worthwhile in this stage of our recovery, no matter how long you've been sober. That is, we must do all we can to regain a mature and strong self-image. We must realize our own dignity, our own value. We must be assertive in defending our own rights. Absolutely. And we must be confident and optimistic at all times. That is, we must rediscover our own identity. Sometimes our identity is lost under a veneer, a large veneer of protective enamel, protective lacquery. And we don't know ourselves, and other people don't know what's under that lacquer or that paint. They don't know. So therefore, I think during this retreat that we can make an effort to rediscover our true self, to rediscover who I am. And I'm not just putting out words. I might have an outline here, but I have to. But what I'm telling you is all my own personal, sincere belief. Because I've found that 99.9% of all alcoholics coming off severe drinking bouts, this almost 100% of alcoholics have lost their feeling of worth. They've lost their feeling of value. You see? And we have to regain that and preserve it. Now, as far as the future is, we have to be confident and optimistic about the future. No question about it. We need to be more optimistic. And to say to yourself, I am going to make it. I am going to achieve my goals. Because I have the help of my higher power, and I have my own talent, which we all have. And it's amazing how many people have stuck with it and finally achieved great success, whether in the singing field or acting field or so on. And I'm amazed at some of the people from Seattle who have gone on, or Tacoma, who've gone on to great things, for example, in movies or television. There are several who have bought homes there. And one is Deanne Cannon from Tacoma, who went on after a long series of disappointments to become a successful actress. Now here, to be yourself and act yourself without imitating others. I believe for a long time that we tend to imitate other people to our own disadvantage. That is, as soon as we are in contact with some personality or someone different from ourselves, we tend to take on their way of living and their peculiarities, even their eccentricities. Well, now that can lead to trouble because imitators do not rediscover themselves. They discover the other person, not who they are. And we need to know who we are. Another point that I can make is this, that it is up to you at all times. And I'm going to read the words of a great writer who wrote about education, Cardinal John Newman. God has created me to do him some definite service. He has committed some future work to me, which he has not committed to another. I have my mission. I am a link in a chain, a bond of connection between persons. God has not created me for naught. I shall do good. I shall do his work. Therefore, I will trust in him, my higher power. Whatever or wherever I am, I can never be thrown away. You're not going to be thrown away by anybody unless you do it yourself. And I like this one with regard to love by the French writer Etienne de Grelier. I shall pass through this life but once. Any good, therefore, that I can do, or any kindness I can show to any fellow creature, let me do it now. Let me not defer or neglect it, for I shall not pass this way again. We only have a few years here. We might as well spend it in love and service of others. And now, if you will, I would like to read a couple of statements from the co-founder of AA, Mr. Bill Wilson. From the 12 and 12 book, quote, not everybody can truthfully assert that they love everybody. First of all, we should try to stop making unreasonable demands upon people we love. Unreasonable demands. We can show loving kindness where we had formerly shown none. With those people we dislike, we can at least begin to practice justice and courtesy, perhaps going out of our way to understand and help them. And another one that he wrote. This is about honesty, which you already mentioned. Sometimes we need to place love ahead of indiscriminate actual honesty. We cannot, for example, under the guise of perfect honesty, we cannot cruelly and unnecessarily hurt others. Always one must ask himself, what is the best and most loving thing I can do? What is the best and most loving thing I can do? So sometimes it's better not to be absolutely honest. For example, now you're in a great mood of honesty, and you are going to tell your loving spouse about all the motels and girls you were with when you were drunk. Well, it is not exactly advisable to give her a list of the girls you were with and what motels you were in. You see, I don't recommend that. So sometimes absolute honesty has its limitation because of love. You see? The same way you don't tell everybody you meet, my God, what an awful tie. Where did you get that? Or what a horrible hairdo, Marie. Why did you change your old hairdo? No, we have to remember that love comes ahead even of honesty. All right? Now this one, be yourself and act yourself, has a wonderful word in it, unique. That is, you are a unique personality. That is an interesting word because it doesn't mean that you are one human person. It means that you are so much one that you are a whole species in yourself. That is, as if you were a whole species. You are so unique in your total personality that it is as if you were only the last tiger left on earth, or there was only one leopard left on earth, or one lion. That's how unique you are, almost as if you were the whole species. You are so different from others. So dare to cultivate your own unicity. your own uniqueness. And even people like Robert Goulet have stressed that, whether I'm right or whether I'm wrong, whether I find a place in this world or never belong, I've got to be free. I've got to be me. I've got to be me, not somebody else. You've got to make your own kind of music, sing your own special song, even if nobody else sings along. Make your own music. Don't imitate others. Now we come to number D. Try to accept yourself, others around you, and events that happen to you. We already mentioned the words of Bill Wilson, that we should keep in mind that 100% sobriety involves, number one, acceptance, and number two, some kind of faith. And I would expand that to his further words on acceptance, namely on page 44. Our very first problem is to accept our present circumstances as they are, to accept ourselves as we are, and the people about us as they are. This means to adopt a realistic humility, without which no genuine advance can even begin. So we ask ourselves if we are trying to practice at least mature acceptance of our living conditions, if not happy, ecstatic acceptance. What we need here is a patient acceptance and a desire to cope with adverse conditions. That will make you a lot happier, because not everything in life is perfect. I beg your pardon. What? Lynn Anderson's big hit. I never promised you a rose garden. If anybody promised you a rose garden for the rest of your life, go up and hit him in the teeth. Because you can be happy, certainly, but you're going to find thorns among the roses. Absolutely. Now, number E. This is the reverse side of love. Try to serve other people in some way. Extend yourself. Put yourself out. If you want to watch a football game, perhaps your real duty is to go up to the hospital and visit somebody. I know I missed a whole football game the other day because I had to visit persons in three hospitals. But when it was all over, I was really happy that I had, because I realized that I had tried to love somebody, the reverse side of the coin of love. Besides, when you get to know another person better, you come to appreciate and love that person, and you want to serve him or her. You want to help him or her. Finally, here's a song that expresses it. He ain't heavy, he's my brother. The slogan of Boys Town in Nebraska. Well, she ain't heavy, she's my sister. Therefore, I will carry him or her on my shoulders for a while until they are strong enough to walk alone. To walk alone. I give to you and you give to me true love, true love. There's another golden oldie that expresses it very well. I'm a golden oldie myself. You remember that old one, I want to be happy, but I won't be happy till I make you happy too. I won't really be happy till I'm trying to make you happy also. That's really the full satisfaction of life, trying to make others happy. And finally, let's come down to number three, the third supportive pillar of our mature growth and the regaining of maturity lost through alcoholism. To be creative in your own way. It has been said that every human being is born creative, and I'm a subscriber to that belief, because in the Christian view, which I embrace, God is the creator. That is, he is infinitely creative, and he can create practically anything. And according to Christian theology, at the end of this universe, he will create a perfect, very beautiful universe. You don't have to subscribe to that to believe that human beings are creative. You don't have to bring in the creator at all. Because we see creative people everywhere. And I don't mean just in the movies or TV and so on, or great artists like Picasso. But I mean all around us we see creative people. And that is fulfilling, because we have an inclination, a yearning to be creative, to leave behind our impression on this tiny planet Earth. And Bill Wilson insisted on that. I'm going to read something if I remember. But he wrote a whole letter about heaven. It's right in this book. To a friend whom he considered very creative and who was dying. And he told him that he should look forward now to the Elysian field, a Greek expression for heaven. Now, you can be creative either in the work that you do or outside of the work that you do. Some of us are just putting nuts on the bolts, I guess. And it's not very creative. We're standing at an assembly line, I don't know. Others find great creativity in their chosen work. And I think that's a very beautiful and satisfying thing. In my own work, I can be very creative and express my own talent and energy. So I'm very satisfied, and I need that creative energy. Others express it in music, painting, going back to college, even going back to community colleges for a couple of night courses. I'm astonished at how many of my cousins over 60 years of age are now going back and taking night classes. And they're really tickled about that. One's taking architecture, another real estate. So going back to college or some educational courses offered is very creative. Others take up knitting or macrame. Others do more writing or try to do more speaking, especially to try to encourage their own interest in speaking at meetings. And I certainly am all for that. I know that people who are creative and keep it up are very, very happy people. At least they're satisfied with living. One is Ginger Rogers, whom I heard a couple of years ago in Las Vegas. She's now 69 and still bouncing around, dancing and singing, wearing out her male partners. Vincent Lopez died. He died when he was conducting his orchestra. Guy Lombardo died at 75, still creative, still conducting his orchestra. Xavier Cugat is now touring Japan in 30 cities. He's 80 years old, the rumba king of the world. So you don't have to quit at 60 or 65. You should keep on being creative. And I'm amazed at these we call them older adults, touring the country in their, what do you call those things? Those mobiles, those motor vans. And they're getting a big charge out of visiting inaccessible places and so forth and seeing things they wanted to see all their lives. Well, even retirement can be creative. Yeah, even retirement. So there will never be another you. And that's the whole burden of what I've been trying to say today. And I hope that you will meditate on it, that you definitely need to rediscover your own ability and talents, to rediscover yourself. Let me close with two little short essays. First, this is maturity, to be able to stick with a job until it is finished. Secondly, to be able to bear an injustice without trying to get even. Third, to be able to carry money around without spending it. And fourth, to do one's duty every day without being supervised. Now I want to read to you the desiderata, which means things to be desired. For a long time it was thought that this came from a church in Baltimore, but later on they discovered that it was written by a Max Ehrman. Mr. Ehrman, an American drama writer, about 1936. I'll quote this now. Go placidly amid the noise and haste, and remember what peace there may be in silence. As far as possible, without surrender, be on good terms with all persons. Speak your own truth quietly and clearly, and listen to others, even the dull and ignorant. They too have their story. Avoid loud and aggressive persons. They are vexations to the human spirit. If you compare yourself with others, you may become vain and bitter. For always there will be greater and lesser persons than yourself. Enjoy your achievements as well as your plans. Keep interested in your own career, however humble. A career is the real possession in the changing fortunes of time. But exercise caution in your business affairs, because the world is full of trickery. But do not let this blind you to what virtue there is. Many persons strive for high ideals, and life is everywhere full of heroism. Be yourself, especially do not pretend affection, but neither be cynical about love. Take kindly the advice of the years and gratefully surrender the pursuits of youth. Develop strength of spirit to protect you in sudden misfortune, but do not distress yourself with imaginings. Many fears are born out of fatigue and loneliness. Except for a wholesome self-discipline, be gentle with yourself. Be gentle with yourself. And this one was recorded with the background choir. You are a child of the universe, no less than the trees and the stars. You have a right to be here. And whether or not it is clear to you, no doubt the universe is unfolding as it should. Therefore, be at peace with God, whatever you conceive Him to be, and whatever your labors and aspirations, in the noisy confusion of life, keep peace with your soul. With all its sham, drudgery, and broken dreams, it is still a beautiful world. Be careful. Strive to be happy. Thank you.